All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a packed show for you today. We're going to open up with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party talking about the upcoming trial of George Zimmerman, the vigilante would-be cop who murdered Trayvon Martin a year ago February. And that trial's starting up down in Sanford, Florida. And we're also going to be joined later on in the show by Richard Rowley, the director of Dirty Wars. And at the back end of the show, we are going to have a special segment. Over the last week, a whole lot of people have been out there talking about, horrified and really angered by, the latest in the criminal actions by the Obama regime. The latest being the revelation that Obama and his henchmen have been spying on hundreds of millions of people in this country, okay? And they've been checking emails, they've been gathering up phone calls, seeing who's been naughty and who's been nice, all of that, actual crimes against the people in this country. And this is something that, again, we're learning that the Constitution really means very little when it comes to the needs of the imperial ruler. So we're going to be listening to a segment from Babavakian's speech, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, Babavakian Live. And that this section of the speech is on Obama worse than Bush. All right, so stay tuned for that one. So this is the show we have up for you. So we're going to bring Carl on to the show right now. Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party. Welcome to the show, and how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Michael, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, it's, in addition to the joy of having you, the pleasure you always give us when you come onto the show, we're also basically looking at this. This is an extremely important time right now, and what you're involved in is an extremely important issue. You know, people know from your past visits to the show, you're deeply involved in the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And right now, what's going on down in Sanford, Florida is something that everyone in the entire country needs to be following and checking out. You know, this is the trial of George Zimmerman, as I said in opening the show up, the vigilante would-be cop who murdered Trayvon Martin back in February of 2012 is set to begin this coming Monday. And we want to talk about the importance of this trial. We want to talk about where things are at now, the importance of this trial, and why people should do not just give a damn, but actually stand up and fight for justice for Trayvon and beyond that. So, Carl, why don't we open up by you telling people where are things at now in relation to the Zimmerman trial and the murder of Trayvon Martin?
Well, where things are at is that, first off, the only reason there is a trial is because people stood up last year. Because as everybody who knows about this case recalls, the cops in Sanford came upon Zimmerman standing over the dead body of Trayvon, holding the murder weapon in his hand, walked him into the police station through one door and out through the other in a matter of minutes, letting him go. And only because there was outrage displayed in the streets all across the country did they back up and put him on trial. This trial is about to open, and increasingly the eyes not only of the country but of the world is going to be focused on this case. And the very big question is, what are they going to see? Because what they're seeing right now is Trayvon being put on trial. You know, stories being released about his supposedly sealed juvenile record, his school disciplinary record, pictures and rumors about whether he smoked marijuana, whether he gave somebody the finger, maybe got involved in some fights, all of which have nothing to do with what this case is about. This case is about Zimmerman seeing a young black man, deciding that he's a criminal, stalking him and gunning him down. That's what this case is about. And the authorities have tried to make it about everything else, even down to the fact that they drug tested Trayvon's dead body, but did not bother to drug test the person who killed Trayvon. There's been a straight up attempt to make this case an affirmation of open season on black youth, you know, affixing the bullseye to their backs. But for many, many people, they got this last year, and that's why they acted, because black and Latino youth felt like we could have been Trayvon. Black people felt like that could have been my son, that could have been my cousin, that could have been my brother. And even people, white people, some of them saw this and said, well, wait a minute. maybe I wouldn't have ended up in that situation, but I don't want to live in the world where that is the order of things and the way things go down. Well, everybody who felt that way has got to step out again, because what will the world see? Will they only see the system working to exonerate the racist vigilante who murdered a black youth? Or will they also see thousands and thousands of people standing up in outrage over that reality of open season on black youth that the racial profiling of this system brings down on people?
Well, tell me this, Carl, because you hit on, so there's a bunch of things that you hit on in an overview that I want to touch on in particular. And one is, you know, this point, there is the point of justice for Trayvon, and it's very important. And we'll talk about more about what's concentrated in that in terms of the stakes. But I want to know what actually, you know, there's been a lot of, and I know Revolution Newspaper has talked about this. There's a lot concentrated in this whole battle around Trayvon, and you started to speak to some of it. I think there's, you know, this idea, for instance, the question you're always talking about, which is extremely important, which is the point of slow genocide, and what does that have to do? Is there some kind of point of connection between what happened to Trayvon, what's going on around this trial, and this whole program that's actually being implemented against black people?
Yeah, there's a very, very direct connection, because the racial profiling that Zimmerman applied is the overall approach of this system towards black people and Latino people. People to be treated as guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. And this doesn't just flow from some reactionary thinking on the part of some white people or on the part of some cops, but it is a enforcement mechanism for an entire system, a system that has operated in such a way that leaves whole generations of black and Latino youth in the inner cities with no future, because the jobs that their parents were drawn into those cities to work in have now moved halfway around the world, where they can find people they can work in much more dangerous conditions for longer hours for less money. That's leaving people with no legitimate means to survive, people who have been failed by the educational system, and their answer to that has been a program of suppression over the last 40 years, and that is why there's been an eightfold leap in the number of people in prison, largely concentrated among black and Latino people. That's why when you look at things like marijuana arrests, black people are four times as likely to be arrested for marijuana as white people, even though all government studies show that white people use marijuana in equal numbers, you know, and their existence in the population. That's why the Congress passed a 100-to-1 law, sentencing law, around the disparity between crack and powder cocaine, giving 100 times the penalty for possession of crack cocaine as it gave for powder cocaine. All of that was a question of targeting a section of people that they had no future for, and whose response to that lack of future they feared and they wanted to lock down. That's what we're dealing with here when we deal with this case, and that's why so many people felt like we could have been Trayvon and were in the streets saying we are all Trayvon, because the racial profiling that Zimmerman applied to Trayvon reflects the same approach that police departments across the country take in approaching black and Latino communities. So it's a concentration of the same program, and that's why I proposed to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network that it take this up, and why it did take it up, and why there are going to be hoodie days in cities across the country, people stepping out into the streets saying, we will not silently accept a declaration of open season on black youth.
We'll talk about that in a second, Carl. We'll talk about that in a second, because I do want to get into the plans and the way that this is going to be fought out. But first, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the Revolutionary Communist Party. And we're talking about the stakes involved in the fight for justice for Trayvon Martin as the trial of George Zimmerman the vigilante would-be cop who murdered Trayvon Martin. I wanted to pursue a few other things first. You know, you made the point about a system behind the murder of Trayvon and behind the trial, of the way the trial is being carried out around Zimmerman and all the stuff that's wound up in that. And you know, I think one of the things that when we say that, I mean, you gave a lot of, you know, examples of what's happening to people. But when people might say, like, well, look, how can you, you know, what is it that would make you say that this is actually not just a series of, like, you know, knuckleheaded, racist, boss hog type people down in Florida that are doing this stuff. And instead, or even elsewhere in the country, that it's the Republican program or it's this or it's that, you know, because there's a whole lot of people making this argument that, you know, and I think it's really, it goes along with the way that people make an argument that we can get things better if we just, you know, pressure politicians, if we do this, if we do that. And there's a question here, if you raise, which I think is a very deep question, is, it's a system here, and we're talking about not just it's systematic, but it's a system that actually is putting this into practice and it actually is enforcing this. And you know, that's what we're dealing with. We're not just dealing with, you know, a racist, you know, knucklehead cop in Sanford, Florida, or Brooklyn. We're dealing with a big system.
Yeah, and see, that's the reality that I've been working at trying to get more and more people to see, that when you see large numbers of youth from the inner city going in and out of prison, that what this is about isn't their bad choices or their failure to take responsibility, but them being confronted with a system, a situation that limits their choices. They didn't move the factories halfway around the world. The operation of the capitalist system and its chase after profits dictated that. That meant that there was a lack of legitimate means for these youth to survive and to raise families. They didn't cut funding for the educational system. They're not closing the schools in the inner cities like's going on in Chicago, in Philadelphia, and other cities. Those were things that were done by the folks operating the system, trying to, you know, hone in their system, how it operates, and cutting what they saw as superfluous funding. That leaves these youth in situations where they got to come up with some hustle, legal or illegal, to survive, and they get preyed upon by the police departments of this system. So what you're dealing with is you're dealing with the operation of the economic system of capitalism combined with conscious policies adopted by the authorities that run that system, which, one, leave our youth with no future, and then target them to suppress them because they don't want this generation of Black and Latino youth doing what earlier generations of Black youth did in the 1960s when they rose up against the conditions that were being enforced on them and rocked the whole system back on its heels. That's what we're dealing with, and that's why in my dialogue with Cornel West, I put it this way. This is a horrific reality that comes down to a slow genocide that is breaking the bodies and crushing the spirits of far too many of our youth. It's built within the fabric of the system. It's going to take revolution, nothing less, to get rid of it. And right now, today, that calls for mass determined resistance on the part of everybody who's got an ounce of justice in their hearts.
Well, let me ask you this, Carl. When you get to that point, what are the stakes involved in this struggle right now? What are the stakes?
Well, the stakes are that with this case around Trayvon Martin, it's not a neutral thing or just the case about one person, because the defense that's being put forward for Zimmerman is essentially that he made the correct choice by seeing this Black youth and deciding that he was criminal. Letting him walk again is basically endorsing that justification, that you see a Black or Latino youth, yeah, the right decision to make is that we're dealing with criminals here and we can sort it out later. That's a decision that gets made all the time and leads to large numbers of innocent Black and Latino youth being brutalized, arrested for nothing and even murdered by police departments all across the country. So all of that is involved here. And if people accept this without resistance, it actually allows that program to continue going forward and to intensify. It won't just stay where it is. It'll go forward and intensify. But if we succeed in meeting it with resistance, if the resistance becomes increasingly strong, but also increasingly clear on where all this is coming from, then we can go forward from fighting this particular battle to taking on the whole repressive program of mass incarceration and all of its consequences. And that's the approach that the Stop Mass Incarceration Network is trying to take. And I'm involved in that as a revolutionary communist.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dixon of Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, just to continue along these lines of the stakes and what's going on with this, you know, one of the things that's interesting is when Trayvon was murdered and shortly thereafter, there was a point that was made in a statement that was drawn up and people signed on to, which is the no more, right?
We say no more.
Which was extremely important. And one of the things in terms of the number of people and the kinds of people that stood up to sign on to this and to state their outrage and their just the way that they were saying, look, seriously, no more. And part of this, I think, you know, I was just thinking as you're talking, you know, the ways that this all comes down, in a lot of ways, it reminded me in some ways, and this isn't that big of a stretch, really, you know, it reminded me in some ways of Katrina in that and what happened to Katrina and what people saw in Katrina in that it really kind of laid bare and corresponded to such profound injustices and inequalities in this society that people were moved by more than the outrage at the murder of one young man, one young black man. They were moved by what was this whole way that you've been talking about, this concentration of injustice and inequality and oppression and repression that really, I think, one, really talks a lot about the basis for people to stand up and step out against a whole lot of stuff, but it really, really speaks to how important it is and what a difference it makes when people actually do stand up and when they actually can see what's concentrated here.
Yeah, see, I think that's important to get at because when people saw this particular murder, they saw the injustice of it, but they also, many of them saw the interconnection of that with their own circumstances and things that had happened in their experience. And that's part of why things like parents of police murder victims are trying to get to Sanford. It's part of a We Are All Trayvon delegation down there that the Stop Mass Incarceration Network is working on.
That's going on now as we speak?
That's being worked on right now, and they're trying to get down there for the 10th. And hopefully some of them will be speaking to the media from down there, along with others who are going down. But it reflects that people saw the interconnection and saw that this injustice was not an injustice off by itself, but concentrated a much broader injustice that was going on. And the grasping of that was very important at that point. And it's important that people not go to sleep on that, move on to the next outrage, but actually carry through and see to it that when the eyes of the world refocus on this, that they see a two-sided thing. They see the people who were outraged by this remain outraged around it and are acting around it.
You know, one of the things, Carl, you and I were both down in Sanford the end of last spring.
Exactly a year ago.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that really struck me, I mean, I wrote a lot about this and actually played some of the interviews on the show. When you went out among the people, you know, it's one thing, the difference that people can make, you know, standing up against this as a whole. But it's also true that the people that living in Sanford, I mean, you know, this is, even though I said this is not, this murder of Trayvon and the trial of Zimmerman is not sort of just a question of like, you know, a sort of bizarro land world of you know, a fascist Andy Griffith and all this other stuff, right? You know, Andy of Mayberry. But this is actually, this really is that kind of like, when the people living there, the people, black people living in Sanford really, really do live under a very large gun, you know, and it was, and it was very heavy to see, one, when people saw, when they stepped out and people, you know, and people around the country saw that and around the world saw that. Then they came, and people did come, they came to support this. And when we were down there, you know, and talking to people, person after person talked about what a difference it made, what a difference it made in terms of people from all over standing up, coming there, you know, showing their support, speaking out against this, demanding justice for Trayvon, that it really did not only built the movement overall, but actually gave very important support to the people who are living right there under the gun.
Yeah, because people on the bottom of society, they get messages direct and implied that nobody cares about what happens to them, that it's their own fault anyway, and even if it's not, nobody else cares, so they're on their own. And it's important for them to get that when they stand up and act against injustice, they can bring that injustice out to the eyes of others, and others can and will come to their side. That's going to be an important part of this battle, both around the injustice going down around Trayvon, but the overall injustice of mass incarceration, letting people know what's going on, seeing people who are suffering under this, standing up against it, and attracting others who may not at this point know about it or know clearly about it, but once it's clearly brought to their attention and their challenge to stand against it can be won over. That's an important interconnection and synergy that we have to get going. That's going to be important for the battles against this injustice, and it's going to be important for bringing forward a movement for revolution, which is what we need to get rid of this madness once and for all.
Mm-hmm. Well, in line with that, let me again remind listeners that we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we're talking about the fight around the justice for Trayvon Martin and the fight against the system that's behind it, but people really standing up and demanding justice, not allowing the system to just roll over this. And once again, even you know the impact of what Carl was saying earlier, how this actually impacts and strengthens. If they get away with what they're trying to do here, if they get away with this sort of the whitewashing and the criminalizing and the demonization of Trayvon and the approval, the justification of what Zimmerman did, if they get away with that, that is going to have such huge impact. It's, you know, people need to think about that big, what it does in terms of what it's strengthening, the pole that it's strengthening in society. Along with that, Carl, I wanted you to talk a little bit about the plans that the Stop Mass Incarceration Network has and other people has for this period of time around the time of the Zimmerman trial.
Okay, the plans are there's a call for a nationwide hoodie day on June 10th under the theme of We Are All Trayvon, The Whole Damn System is Guilty. That call is being taken up in cities across the country. We're getting information from Buffalo, New York, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Dallas, Texas, New York, L.A., the San Francisco area. People are also going down from Atlanta and some other cities to Sanford. And people across the country are developing their plans. We're getting people sending us pictures of themselves and their classmates or their friends posing in hoodies with signs that say, We Are All Trayvon. And there's an intensive social media effort of people getting on Twitter and on Facebook and taking out the messages that We Are All Trayvon and that we refuse to accept open season on black youth. And a way that people can get involved in this social media offensive and the Twitter storm is to go to the website of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and that is www.stopmassincarceration.org. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, no punctuation, .org. And people who want to get more deeply into the question of the murder of Trayvon and what's at stake can go to a lead article in Revolution newspaper this week that they could find online at www.revcom.us. That's R-E-V-C-O-M.us.
All right. And people should know that that also revcom.us is also a spot where you will be able to follow the developments in the course of this whole of the trial and the struggle around this as it goes. There'll be day to day coverage almost of what's developing down there, and people really shining a spotlight on that, both in terms of the particular that's going on there as well as how it fits into the overall picture. And that's extremely important. Carl, any closing words?
Well, I just gave the website, so all I want to say is that there is a lot at stake. The eyes of the world are going to be looking at this case, and we have to make sure that they not only see the attempts of the system to exonerate this racist murderer and affirm a declaration of open season on black people, they have to see people out in the streets saying, we refuse to accept this in silence any longer.
All right, Carl, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
All right, take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party around the battle for justice for Trayvon, and we're saying we are all Trayvon, the whole damn system is guilty, and we've been talking about the upcoming trial of George Zimmerman, the murderous, vigilante, would-be cop who cold-bloodedly killed Trayvon Martin February 2012, I think it was February 26th. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Richard Rowley, the director of the film Dirty Wars. So stay tuned. Right, all right, we've got to get it together, all right? Yeah, you know what that's saying. You know what we're talking about here. And joining us now in studio, live in studio, I'm staring at him. I know he's breathing. He's sitting here. His name is Richard Rowley, Rick Rowley. And he is the director of the film Dirty Wars. And I have to tell you, I saw that film at Sundance this year. I was really impressed with it. It's a really great film. It's something that leaves your stomach upside down and your head burning, all right? Rick, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me here, Michael.
Sure. Let's talk about the film. Give people a sense of the film.
So Dirty Wars is a film about the global covert war on terror on and off of stated battlefields in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. But, you know, it didn't really start that way. Jeremy Scahill and myself teamed up to make this film, begin this film 3 years ago. And when we started, we thought it was just going to be a film about Afghanistan because both of us had been covering the war for a while. I'd been embedded there multiple times and unembedded multiple times. And what we were really seeing on the ground was that the conventional war there was being completely eclipsed by the covert war. So, I mean, I would be rolling around with Marines and Marja who would be, you know, going on meaningless presence patrols during the day whose only purpose was to get shot at so they could return fire, or building schools that people were too afraid to attend, or digging wells for agricultural projects that collapse. But we're not engaging with the enemy, as they call them. But then yet every night we'd go back to base and we would hear press releases about all these dazzlingly successful raids that were supposedly going on at night. You know, 10 to 20 raids a night where, you know, dozens of Taliban field commanders, whatever that means, were being captured or detained or killed. But no one knew anything about these raids. The public affairs officers couldn't tell us what units were doing them. They couldn't offer up commanding officers for interviews. They couldn't give us embeds. We were, you know, we were on our own. So Jeremy and I disembedded. We left the safety of, you know, a U.S. military embed in the green zone. We went out and tried to track down the truth behind what was going on. So we used the list of raids as kind of a map to this hidden war. And we went to every single place where a raid was mentioned that we could reach from Kabul because it was very dangerous once we got outside, and, you know, tried to see the reality of the war. And so we went to several, and you know, and we heard all sorts of horrifying stories, but there was one raid that really became a focus for us and sort of an obsession with us. It was a raid in which the military press release said that a combined force of U.S. and Afghan troops, which is what they call these, these special operations raids, was raiding a Taliban compound and stumbled upon an honor killing, where a barbaric ritual in which some, you know, Taliban men had killed their own daughters, their own pregnant daughters, and these heroic soldiers had unfortunately arrived just a moments too late to save these dead women, but they killed the Taliban commanders and captured a few of them. This sounded like an improbable story. If it were true, it would be a spectacular and bizarre and strange and unique story. So we went out to investigate it, and we quickly discovered that was not the case at all. That in fact, what had happened was the U.S. was maybe fed bad intelligence. They arrived at a house where a party was going on. It was a naming celebration for a child who had just been born into the family, and they came in and they killed two very important, the chief prosecutor for the state. We were in a high-ranking police officer and these women, and then the Afghans we talked to said that they saw the soldiers dig the bullets out of the women's bodies. And then they were arrested and they were taken away, dug the bullets out to cover up the action because you could see from the caliber of the bullet which force had killed them. And that sounded completely, outlandish and difficult to imagine that possibly true. I mean, why, like, that was so obscene. But so we hesitated to report that. But then there were other investigations began to happen. The UN had its own internal investigation that was never made public. And then the Afghan police went into a forensic examination. And at the end of this whole process, it was demonstrated in these investigations that, in fact, that was the case, that the bullets were dug out of the bodies. So when this friend of ours is a great reporter there who was also pushing really hard on this, Jerome Starkey from the Times of London, he went to press with that story about the bullets being dug up and the cover-up. In the middle of the night, he got a phone call from NATO saying, we just want to let you know first, we're changing our version of events. We're retracting our press release, and we're admitting that we killed these women and that it was just a horrible mistake. So we thought, okay, case closed. The bad guys have been brought to justice. Well, the truth has been revealed. Probably there won't be justice for these guys, but at least we know what really happened there. We thought it was over, but then there was a photograph that hung over the case and sort of made it impossible for us to drop it. The next day, or a few days later, this convoy of Afghan military personnel arrived at this compound, and out of it came this U.S. admiral, who no one really recognized at the time. And a photo was taken of him offering to sacrifice sheep at the doorstep of the of this family. And that photo was of Admiral William McRaven, who at the time no one knew, but who now is famous, as the man who led the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, and is now was promoted after that to be the head of the entire Special Operations Command, SOCOM in general. So we had this picture, but we didn't know at the time. I mean, he wasn't from NATO command in Kabul. He wasn't from the RC East that controlled that battle space. He wasn't even part of the conventional NATO force there. But Jeremy, quickly discovered through his investigation that he was the head of the Joint Special Operations Command, this secret elite force that is outside of the normal military chain of command and is responsible directly to the executive wing of the president himself. This force that is supposed to do, surgical, precise, and very rare raids that are of the utmost national security significance, like hostage rescue missions. If a nuclear weapon is stolen from the Ukraine, they're supposed to go in and lock it down. So it was a force that never numbered over a few hundred before September 11th, maybe 1,000 at their peak. But now this force was not going after, terrorist masterminds. It was kicking in the doors on farmers in Gardez, who were not a strategic threat to the U.S. So that launched us into an investigation that where we tried to track other strikes that this unit was doing, which took us to Yemen, to Somalia, and beyond.
All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Richard Rowley, the director of the film Dirty Wars, which is based on Jeremy Scahill's book by the same name, and it's also a film in its own right that's actually very, very powerful, very just, like I said, it's bone chilling and it's enraging. It's really enraging. You know, one of the things I have to tell you, Rick, one of the things when I saw this and I kept thinking about this JSOC outfit and all this stuff. But there's, you know, there's a correlation between the terror that's unleashed in terms of just the presence of the U.S. military, this huge oppressive imperial force that's out there, and then these people that go around in a way, it reminds you a little bit of Colonel Kurtz, you know, and it reminds you of Kurtz in Heart of Darkness, Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now, and it reminds you so much of the units that went out in Vietnam and collected ears and did the things of the slitting open the guts of pregnant women and all of these things that were just absolute horrifying terror that was unleashed. And it's interesting because you guys titled your film, you know, The World is a Battlefield. You know, and that was, and I think you're getting into that now in terms of this is the mode of operation of U.S. imperialism around the world.
So this force, JSOC, you know, that was supposed to be saved for very particular tiny, you know, actions, it was, you know, taking over the largest conventional war on the planet and was operating in dozens of countries. Under the Bush administration, the AQN XOR, the Al-Qaeda Network Execute Order, was issued that authorized them to operate on 26 countries off of any stated battlefield. Then under Obama, it was expanded to over 70 countries. And now it was leaked, I think it was in the Times a while back, that there was a day last year when there were JSOC troops on the ground in 100 countries on the same day. So it's dozens of wars being fought in our name, but without our knowledge and without any meaningful congressional oversight.
Absolutely astounding. And this film is opening up in cities across the country.
If we get huge turnouts in these three cities, it'll go to 100 cities. We're hopeful that we can push this over a tipping point and really begin a national conversation about these wars that are being fought in our name but without our knowledge.
Rick, thanks.
Thanks, man.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with Richard Rowley, the director of the film Dirty Wars, and that's based on the book by the same name by Jeremy Scahill. And we're going to take a quick musical break. And when we come back, we'll be listening to a special segment, a portion of a speech delivered by Bob Avakian in the late fall of 2012. And this is related to all the crimes against the people that the Obama administration just keeps on pumping out. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That's Volunteers from the Jefferson Airplane. And man, does that have a lot to do with today's show and this next segment in particular. And, you know, just a little while ago, a little bit more than a week ago, Edward Snowden, a young man who was working in national security, he was a private contractor for national security work. And he basically learned a lot of things that a lot of us don't know about. We might suspect things, but we just don't know about them. And what Edward Snowden found out was that the Obama administration is not only continuing the practices of the Bush administration, but it has also gone way beyond all that, where hundreds of millions of people in this country are being spied on regularly and thoroughly. Their phone calls copied down, you know, logged in. They know where you're going. The idea of Big Brother has become the biggest bully brother, okay? And here it is, the phone calls that they're tracking, the emails that they're spying in on, that they're tracking, all of this led Edward Snowden to say, I do not want to live in a society that could do this, all right? And that was, he was sick and tired of the kind of society that we're living in. And that led Edward Snowden to blow the whistle and all that, and it should lead all of us to make sure that we have his back in the days, weeks, and months to come. And I think a whole lot of us are also sick and tired of this kind of society for a very large number of reasons. But the fact is that this society is raising constantly, day in and day out, the question of whither humanity, what the hell is going to happen with us? And so I thought it'd be very good to listen to this segment from a speech that Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, gave back in late 2012. And this excerpt of the speech is taken from a DVD called B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, Bob Avakian Live. And in this excerpt, he gets into Obama is, in fact, worse than Bush. So check this out and get angrier.
And let's be real here. Let's not dance around the issue. Let's get right to it. As bad as Bush was, in many ways, Obama is even worse. And what's happening under Obama is worse. Things that people would never have put up under Bush, they put up with now, silently and in paralysis under Obama. And I don't want to pick on him in particular, but I can't help thinking of Michael Eric Dyson. Now, he wrote this book a while ago, taking on the whole Bill Cosby thing of blaming the masses of black people and youth for their conditions, ridiculing the kind of names that women come up to name their baby. I always thought those names were tremendously creative, by the way. But he's denouncing them for those names and for the, you know, the old tired thing about pull up your pants and be respectful, as if that's why they're in the conditions they're in. So here we have the situation where Obama comes into office, and the first thing he does is go do his Bill Cosby act at a black church, preach on Father's Day, if I'm not mistaken, preaching all this stuff about, you know, well, all the men who were in prison. Well, who put them in prison? Who created the conditions where they had very few options besides the ones that would land them dead or in prison? Talking about, once again, get right, get serious, pull up your pants. All this kind of stuff. Obama doing his Bill Cosby act. And one of the things that we should understand is that with all this talk around the time Obama was first running for president about how this was going to uplift the people and provide a model for the youth and inspire them to greater things, the truth is Obama and his presidency have done tremendous harm to the masses of black people. Why and how? Because the conditions have not improved for the masses. They're still being sent to prison. They're still being stopped and frisked. They're still being shot down in the street. They still can't get any work. Women are still being evicted from the housing project. Nobody talks about that. It's right to talk about and fight against people being in the middle class being evicted from their homes. But what about all the women being evicted out of the housing projects? You won't find that on anybody's lips, hardly. All the conditions are the same or worse, but what happens? Well, now you have a black president, so you have no excuse. And this was run out straight up by some of these right-wing politicians the night Obama was elected. I watched one of them, Bill Bennett, on TV. Now there's no more excuses. If you and three of your friends are hanging out on the street corner in L.A., and you happen to be in violation of some judge's injunction, which should be totally unconstitutional, which declares that four of you hanging out together constitutes a gang until they can come arrest you, and you start down the pipeline to prison, that's your fault, because there's a black president and you got no excuses. If you're trying to keep your son, if you look out the window and see the police moving toward your son, and you run out the door to try to save your son, and you're too late, and they shoot him down, that's your fault, because there's a black president, and you have no excuses. If you have no job, and you're hanging out on the corner, and you get caught up in some mess with some gang from another neighborhood, and you shoot somebody, that's your fault. You had other options. You can't say there's any barrier to you because there's a black president. This is a game they're running with Obama, and it's not even a game. It's very serious, and Obama is part of it. And you can't say he's not, because that's why he went and made that speech. No excuses. So the oppression and injustice goes on and gets worse, but now insult is added to the injury, and injury is added to injury because it's your fault. Clear as day, because there's a black president, nothing stands in your way. You can be whatever you want to be. This is doing tremendous harm. It's not neutral, and it's definitely not an inspiration to lift people up. Now, I could go on and on talking about the crimes of the system. The other time I threw out the question, name a continent where these imperialists have not committed terrible atrocities against humanity. Antarctica? Not even there, if you take into account what they're doing to the environment. And I could go on and on with Obama, with his maintaining torture. Closing Guantanamo? That was an election promise from Obama. Still open, last I knew. Meanwhile, he's persecuting Bradley Manning and Julian Assange for revealing cables and other things that brought to light war crimes committed by the U.S. in Iraq and other places. Obama meets every week with his advisors to draw up lists of people that he's going to order be assassinated from the air through drones and in other ways. Without any due process, just on the say-so of the president. And yes, I'm going to come back to Michael Eric Dyson. We're not going to let him get away here. Obama firing drones. Many continents now, not just one or two countries. Killing hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians. Backing Israel to the hilt in all of its crimes. Maintaining people in worse than jail-like conditions in the Gaza Strip and the occupied territories.
You're listening to an excerpt of a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this excerpt is taken from the DVD, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, Bob Avakian Live.
And in all this, you see, Obama is acting on the basic logic of the system of which he is the chief executive and commander-in-chief. The basic logic and the basic assumption that flows from it, that U.S. imperialism has the right to dominate the world, that it has the right to commit as much mayhem and slaughter as it deems necessary to impose and maintain its empire, and it has the right to kill anybody who gets in the way. And now Obama's also got a new law that can hold people in indefinite detention for the rest of your life without even a trial, without any due process, just as he can kill people on his say-so without, you know, we have a great country. It's the rule of law, not the rule of a person. Well, where's the rule of law in that? Even that facade and that charade is gone. Now, just think about this. You can tell a lot about people by the jokes that they tell and the jokes they want to tell. People say, oh, it's just a joke. Don't be offended. But jokes have content. You tell a racist joke, it's not f***ing funny. There was a comedian a little while ago who was telling a joke about rape. And a woman in the audience very righteously said, rape is never funny. And he said, wouldn't it be funny if a bunch of guys raped you now? Ha ha. No. It's not f***ing funny. But what people think is funny and not funny tells you a lot about them. In 2010, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Obama got up and gave these comments. This is supposed to be where they kind of joke around and show they're real human beings with a lighter side while they're killing people all over the world. And here's a joke Obama told, among others. He said, I see the Jonas Brothers are here, some musicians. I see the Jonas Brothers are here. My daughters are big fans. But don't get any ideas, because I got two words for you. Predator drone. You'll never see it coming. Now, this is a joke Obama wanted to tell, because this is how he wanted to portray himself. This is the kind of politician and political leader I am. Think about this joke. First of all, there's the obvious thing about you're making a joke out of killing people from the air with missiles that are fired from these drones that fly over foreign countries. But along with that, look at the view of the relation between men and women that are wrapped up in this joke. These are the old views that the daughters are the property of the father. And the father enters into some sort of negotiation with a suitor before the father will give approval to allow the daughter to marry someone. Not the idea of love between two people and the two people themselves deciding, but the father, the patriarch, is exercising control over his property, his daughters. It's like some old backcountry fool pulls out his shotgun. He ain't gonna have nothing to do with my daughter. Except Obama's not a backcountry fool. Obama's the president of the United States. He's the leader of the free world. He doesn't do it with a Tech 9 or a shotgun. He does it with predator drones. Now think about what it means that this man wants to tell this as a joke and wants people to think about him this way. It's a reflection of the putrid, dying, but still vicious nature of this system.
You're listening to an excerpt of a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this excerpt is taken from the DVD, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, Bob Avakian Live.
Michael Eric Dyson, we got to get back to him. I saw him on a program. He was rationalizing all these things, excusing, trying to justify. Yes, it's bad that we went and bombed Libya. But when people struggle for democracy in a country like that, don't we have an obligation to help them? Now, you see, one hand, you give it with one hand and take it away with the other. Either it was a bad thing to bomb or it was a good thing. Don't try to say one and then the other. But there's a more basic point. Don't we have an obligation to help them? And to this, my answer is, what do you mean we, white man? You remember that joke from back in the 60s about the Lone Ranger? The Lone Ranger was a former Texas Ranger, vicious murderers of Native Americans in Mexico and Mexicans in Texas. And he had a sidekick, Tonto, the Indian. And there's a joke that came up when people started looking at the world differently in the 60s. The joke was that the Lone Ranger and Tonto were surrounded by Indians. And their position was getting more and more difficult. Like they said in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Your situation is helpless. And so at a certain point, when it really looked bad, a Lone Ranger turned to Tonto and said, well, it looks like we're really in trouble here, Tonto. And Tonto said back, what do you mean we, white man? Now, what has happened to Michael Eric Dyson that he's talking about we have to do this on behalf of this system just because it's being presided over by an African-American? And he went on trying to justify, yes, torture's bad, but it's complicated and so on. Now, I thought back to this book that Michael Eric Dyson wrote, taking on Bill Cosby in a pretty good way. And the title of the book was a good one. It said, Is Bill Cosby Right or Has the Black Middle Class Lost Its Mind? And I couldn't help think about this as I listened to Michael Eric Dyson. And again, I'm not just trying to pick on him, and I hope he comes around. But I couldn't help thinking that maybe what should be said is Obama a friend of the oppressed, or has Michael Eric Dyson lost his mind? But I know there are people who recognize and who are affected by the fact that there are a bunch of lunatic, demented racists and Nazi types in this country who hate Obama and can't stand the fact that he's president. This is true. This is undeniable. But this really, if you think about it, is a condemnation of this whole system. Because these are not just a few fringe elements. These include people high up in the Republican Party, part of the overall power structure and ruling class of this country. And this shows you the whole system for what it is. Because every part of the power structure, every part of the ruling class of this country believes that those Republicans are legitimate and qualified to govern in society. If you go to Obama and you say, we know you're running against the Republicans, you want people to vote for you instead of Romney, but do you think the Republicans are unqualified to govern and illegitimate? He would say, no, of course not. It's the great American system. We have two parties. That's why I'm always trying to reach across the aisle. And this tells you something not only about Obama, but about the whole system. It tells you if these people are legitimate and qualified to govern in this whole system is illegitimate. There's a double-sided sword to this demented, racist hatred for Obama, because they get two things out of it. One side, the ones who are into this, rile up their base of people who think like that and get them going in that way. And the other side, the Democrats, come along and take advantage of it and say, see, you may not like Obama. You may be disappointed. He didn't do the things he promised he would do. He didn't turn out to be what you want him to be. But you can't let those people run things, can you? And this is the way they get you. As long as we are confined within and can't, even our imagination can't escape the limits in terms of this system, we're always going to be bounced back and forth and buffeted around in this kind of way, and that we're always going to get played in a much more serious game than three-card Monty. So we have to look at the conflicts and contradictions in this society and in this system as part of the material out of which we build a movement for revolution, which can get to the point where it can fight and have a real fighting chance of getting rid of this system, not playing within it and keeping it going and giving our endorsement to its crimes, which is what we do every time we vote for one of these people.
You're listening to an excerpt of a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this excerpt is taken from the DVD, B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, Bob Avakian Live.
I mean, think about the Clintons. You know, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, all these crimes of Obama, bombing Libya and everything else that I've talked about are her crimes too. But go back a little bit when Bill Clinton was president. After the first war against Iraq in 1991, then Clinton came in. He and Hillary Clinton was not just his wife. She was in her own right a major player in this Clinton administration. They imposed sanctions on Iraq that crippled the sanitation facilities, the water treatment facilities, the medical facilities in such a way, and they enforced it with no-fly zones and bombs and airplanes, in such a way that during the 1990s, over 1 million people in Iraq, that's like one out of every 30 people, died as a result of these sanctions, including over 500,000 children. You take your child to the hospital crying in pain, and they say, we want to help you, but we can't because we don't have the sanitary facilities or the medicine or the technology to treat this because of the sanctions. And the Secretary of State at that time under Clinton was Madeleine Albright, and she went on TV and someone directly asked her, look, all these people, including children, are dying as a result of these sanctions just to try to keep pressure on Saddam Hussein. Do you think it's worth it? And she said, well, it's complicated and it's difficult, but yes, we think it's worth it. These are the kind of people we're being asked to endorse and the kind of monstrous crimes we're being asked to endorse by voting for one politician or the other in this system. And plus, it just reinforces the idea that you can't have any basic change. Because as long as people keep voting for these things, and including some people vote for really bad things, then it just reinforces the idea that we could never have a big change. The terms are the wrong terms. The limits are too narrow. You can't break through and win people away from where they are towards something much better if you are trying to do it within the terms of this system and on the basis of its elections.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And you've just been listening to an excerpt from a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in the late fall of 2012. And this excerpt was taken from the DVD, B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, Bob Avakian Live. And if your interest has been really stoked and you really want to dig into the rest of this DVD, which I highly recommend, go to the site revcom.us. That's revcom.us. Go there and you can find out all you want to know about Avakian, about this DVD, where you can get it, all this other stuff. All right, so check that out. Okay, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in and continuing to tune in. It makes all the difference in the world. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, do it through Facebook and Twitter. All right, and I look forward to hearing from each and every one of you. And if you want to comment on a show or you have questions to ask me, you can do that too by going to michaelslate.wordpress.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more of Jefferson Airplane.